we were in the bathroom getting ready before this. You're like, oh, I had this really tasty mac and cheese. And I was like, Nathaniel, are you lactose intolerant? I would like to know before sitting next to you for an hour and a half. And you were like, you're like, no. And I was like, really? You're the only adult in their 30s I know who isn't in some way lactose intolerant. Wow. And you're like, well, dairy isn't as easy on me as it used to be. And I was like, oh dear, we're in for a long podcast.
I would like to clarify for the record that, like, when I said, like, I can't digest dairy like I used to, it means that I've gone from eating a pint of ice cream at a time to half a pint of ice cream at a time.
Okay.
I can still handle my ice cream, my dairy.
Is this what always happens when you do podcasts in person? It gets this personal.
Scatological
about,
human.
Yeah.
It can get off the rails fast. Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. By the end of this week, the number of major candidates, according to 538's metrics, running for the Republican presidential nomination is expected to grow to 9. That's because 3 people plan to jump in the coming days, Chris Christie on Tuesday, and Mike Pence and Doug Burgum on Wednesday. Now, if you're thinking, to what end with regards to Pence or Christie, or simply, who with regards to Doug Burgum? Well, dear listeners, you are not alone. Today, we're going to talk about how these candidates might shape the race. Also, last Friday, the Republican National Committee announced the date and criteria for the first primary debate. It'll be on August 23rd, and candidates have to sign a pledge to support the eventual nominee, among other things. But most notable for our purposes are the polling criteria. There may not be that many polls that actually qualify, according to the RNC. So is that a good or bad use of polling? And of course, over the weekend, President Biden signed into law a suspension of the debt ceiling through 2025, along with some cuts to federal spending. The large majority that the bill received in the House wasn't quite what some skeptics would have predicted earlier this year. So how'd they get there? And here with me to discuss in studio, no less, we can now widen the shot and you can see everyone here if you're watching along on YouTube or on the ABC website. Here with me in New York, in person, is senior reporter Amelia Thompson DeVoe. Welcome to the podcast, Amelia.
Thank you. It's very exciting to be here in this lovely studio.
Take your shoes off. Make yourself at home.
Oh, I can take
Stay
my shoes
a while.
Off. Great.
Yeah, whatever
yeah.
you want.
Can I sleep under this table?
I mean, it might be hard with all the lights, but after we all leave, you're more than well. You know, later in the day, no one's going to be using the studio. You can use it as you wish. Also here, sitting next to me, is senior elections analyst Nathaniel Rakich. Hello, welcome.
Hey,
how's
Galen.
It going?
Thank you. It's going well. I'm always, you know, not sure whether I should be looking at you or at the camera here.
You should look at me. Pretend they don't exist.
Okay. All right.
Sorry.
Hi, Galen. How's it going?
It's going quite well. I'm excited to have you guys here. I have some housekeeping notes to share before we dive in. So we're going to be publishing one podcast a week for the time being, and it's going to be on Mondays, along with emergency podcasts as the news cycle requires it. Who's to say how often that will happen? I sure can't. The podcasts are going to incorporate parts of what has historically been the Thursday podcast and the Monday podcast. And I'm going to have a little more time to put into each episode, so I'm excited about what we're going to be doing. In case you are worried about this change, I'll let you know that technically it actually started 2 weeks ago. But the first week, we had basically an emergency podcast because Ron DeSantis entered the primary. And then the second week was a holiday week, so we only had one episode anyway. So fear not, you didn't even notice that this already went into effect. So let's...
We're so considerate, Galen.
I know.
You just like eased people in.
You know, some people like change, some people don't like change.
Do you like change, Galen?
It depends on what's changing.
That's a cop-out answer.
Do you like a good change?
I like
not
a good,
a bad
podcast change.
Controversial.
I love a good change.
Controversial.
I love this change. Mm. I hate a bad change.
That's fair.
Yeah, that's so kind of hard to argue with.
That's actually my platform. America for only good change.
Time for a good change.
America, time for a good change.
No bad changes. Thank you. Please and thank you.
Okay, so let's dive into the matter at hand. Over the past week, Congress passed and Biden signed the debt ceiling agreement that we discussed last Tuesday. So as I mentioned, it suspends the debt ceiling through January 2025, aka the next presidential election. It also keeps non-defense discretionary spending at the same levels in 2024 that they've been at in 2023 and only raises it 1% in 2025. The agreement marginally expands work requirements for government benefits like food stamps and rescinds $30 billion in unspent COVID relief. It also cuts part of the IRS funding increase from the Inflation Reduction Act and ensures that student loan repayments will restart by the end of the summer. As part of the agreement, the creation of a natural gas pipeline in West Virginia will be expedited. So, those are some of the details, but all told, this deal saves somewhere in the range of $1 trillion over a decade, during which time the Congressional Budget Office estimates that the U.S. will run $20 trillion in deficits. So, Nathaniel, let's start with this. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. You were vocally skeptical of McCarthy's ability to get a deal after the many rounds of voting that were required in order to make him speaker in the first place. In the end, the vote in the House was 314 yeses to 117 noes. 149 Republicans voted yes, and 71 voted no. Even more Democrats than Republicans voted for the bill, but that's still, you know, overwhelmingly the majority of Republicans. Why, in the end, was the House able to get such an overwhelming bipartisan majority?
Well, because it was a bipartisan bill. I mean, you know.
Oh, come on, Nathaniel.
Well, I mean, it was, I think it was actually, yeah. So like.
So if you call a bill bipartisan, you'll get bipartisan support for it? That sounds like
it was mutually, you know, arrived upon by Biden and, you know, McCarthy and his negotiators. And it seemed like it was pretty equitable. Like it wasn't like clearly a win for one side or the other. In fact, there was some like interesting like stuff about how like, you know, like Democrats were trying not to say that, you know, that they liked the bill because, or that they were fine with the bill because they didn't want to like make it that Republicans got mad that Democrats were too happy about the bill or something like that. But yeah, kind of, as you mentioned, a majority of Republicans and a majority of Democrats both voted for the bill in the House. And while it wouldn't have been able to pass without Democratic support in the House, I think it was also fair to expect a good number of Democrats to go along with it. I think McCarthy, you know, kind of to my earlier criticism or skepticism of him, like he did a good job with this. Like he lost the Freedom Caucus. Basically, those were the Republicans who voted no, right? We were the kind of hardcore conservative Republicans who were really kind of hardline about, no, we need deeper spending cuts. But it didn't end up damaging the bill's prospects of passing. So he, you know, avoided like, you know, basically being left with the bag in terms of a default. And it looks like he's going to maintain his speakership. It seems like he pissed off the Freedom Caucus enough that they voted no against it, but probably not enough to lose the speakership, right? There has been some talk about one of these motions to vacate the chair to basically like a vote of no confidence in his leadership, but I haven't seen anybody really take seriously the idea that McCarthy would lose that, even if it happens. I guess there is an asterisk that like don't know for sure, but he did a good job, getting it through.
But let's be specific about what we thought would happen or what you thought would happen when you were originally skeptical and why it didn't come to pass. Yeah. What were you thinking was going to happen in all of this that would have made, I mean, because back in the day you were thinking like, oh, the U.S. might actually come closer to defaulting than it has in the past. And
yeah,
in the end,
they came to an agreement
it
like
didn't
a week before.
Feel that no, down to the wire this time around. I mean, less so than during Obama's presidency.
Yeah. Yeah, if people remember 2011, that really was down to the wire. I mean, I kind of felt like what was going to happen was that we were going to get really down to the wire, that basically McCarthy wouldn't be able to cut a deal that didn't have the buy-in of the Freedom Caucus, and basically Democrats wouldn't accept anything by the Freedom Caucus. I kind of figured that in the end, Biden or Democrats might pull one of these escape hatches that was available to them, like the 14th Amendment or even like the $1 trillion coin or something like that, or the discharge petition that was floating around, and that, you know, like kind of like Biden would be willing to, you know, kind of take it a little bit farther to the brink as well. But it seemed like both of them came to a gentler, earlier agreement. We didn't default. We didn't come that close in historical context. It didn't end up being, you know, Biden acting unilaterally or whatever.
But I guess, like, why do you think that was, Nathaniel? And I'm not going to call you out as aggressively as Galen did for making a prediction. You're always asking us to make predictions, Galen. And I just want to say that watching this is it makes me a little nervous about saying anything definitive, lest I be aggressively grilled later. But
to be fair, Nathaniel was pretty loose with this prediction. I don't even think I asked him. He was out there being like,
"Oh, yeah. So you're saying this is Nathaniel's fault?" Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway,
that's fine.
Got to be more careful.
I can take my medicine.
Yeah. But I guess what were you expecting about the climate back when we were talking about this back in January, and how did things turn out now? I mean, from my perspective, I was expecting more of an appetite for a game of chicken than actually seemed to be on Capitol Hill. And that was one of the more interesting outcomes of this whole fight, that when it came down to things, people were pretty willing to accept compromise, right. And they were pretty willing, you know, even Biden came in saying, "I'm not going to negotiate at all." And he ended up, you know, with some not huge concessions, but significant concessions to the GOP. And so it's interesting that that's where we are, especially thinking about what happened when Biden was vice president under Obama, where there was much more of a kind of battle to the edge.
Right. I think basically what happened was I overestimated polarization and the impacts of each party's fringe, right? So what happened was that McCarthy accepted a deal that, you know, the Freedom Caucus did not like, and I thought that he would be more kind of held hostage by the Freedom Caucus. At the same time, Biden really rejected the calls from the progressive side of the party to invoke the 14th Amendment or something like that, and he genuinely seemed to want to strike a deal with Republicans, which of course many progressives have criticized him for making bipartisan deals, but it's been a kind of a hallmark of his presidency. Right. And I think in those two ways, the Biden and McCarthy did act more kind of pragmatically, conciliatorily than I was expecting.
Yeah, and really calling the bluff of the fringes too.
Right.
I mean, I think
neither one of them went to war over it.
Yeah, and the Freedom Caucus, I think, comes out of this looking weaker.
Yeah.
Because they came in basically saying, "McCarthy, you're a speaker, but you have to do what we want or we're going to get rid of you." And now, you know, it's, I guess anything is possible, but it doesn't seem like McCarthy is in real danger after cutting this deal that, you know, they really didn't like and were vocally opposed to. So, you know, it's interesting that they actually kind of turned out to be the losers here.
Yeah, I mean, whenever you try to analyze why something has happened in history, you can always look through many different lenses, right? You can look at the individuals involved, which in this case would be McCarthy and Biden. You can look at the overarching ecosystem, which would be the economy and the risks to the economy. You could look at the different institutional players like the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. When it comes down to it, how much does this just have to do with Biden and McCarthy themselves, right? Like, Biden has pitched himself as a unifier, this bipartisan-minded president. McCarthy, while he had to appease the right in order to become speaker, has long been known in Washington as somebody who's not of the Freedom Caucus types. You know, before Trump in particular was thought of as quite a moderate, and thinking about, you know,
well, I think he was thought of as conservative before Trump, but kind of compared to Trump, he's considered more moderate because he's more of an insider, yeah.
But I think he always wanted to be party leadership sort of played nice with everyone in order to try to get there, and so wasn't
not a bumper.
Committed to one wing of the party. I mean, yeah, does this come down to the politics of the person?
I think some of it, probably. I mean, I think from Biden's perspective, I really would not underestimate just the incredible risk this posed to the economy. If we had defaulted, you know, there's been a lot of talk about whether the U.S. is going to go into a recession later this year.
I know we're still waiting.
Yeah, we're still waiting. I know. The recession clock. I know. Yeah.
Recession.
I wrote an article, I think, in 2019 that was called "Economists Are Bad at Predicting Recessions." Mm-hmm. And I wish I could just I should just set it to auto-tweet every 2 weeks to remind people that predictions of recessions are very bad. Don't listen. Economists don't know. Sorry, economists. But, but, you know, if you wanted to kind of guarantee that we would, in fact, go into a recession, defaulting is a really good way to do that, because it was immediately going to put all kinds of people who rely on government payments into really vulnerable financial straits. It was going to cause chaos in the markets. And the economy is already in a fragile enough place that it was especially risky to think about doing that. So I always expected Biden to back off somewhat from his I won't negotiate stance simply because the stakes are so high for him. I mean, if he goes into 2024, his reelection campaign with the economy in a tailspin, that's really, really bad news for him because people are already quite skeptical of his handling of the economy, upset about inflation. So I think from Biden's perspective, it makes sense. And from McCarthy's perspective, you know, I can understand after what happened with his vote in January that he doesn't want to try to cut a deal with the fringes of his party. And he wants to, you know, kind of get past this and get some concessions and move on. Like, they did not make a strong pitch for working together when they almost derailed his speakership campaign. So, you know, in that sense, I think it's not hugely surprising. And I think some of it does have to do with circumstances in addition to personalities.
We talked a little bit last week about whether one side or the other can claim a win here. Obviously, both will spin the results as a win. I think numerically, if you look at sort of where did it come down closer to the over $3 trillion in cuts that the House passed in their initial bill earlier this year, or the zero spending cuts that Biden started with, it's numerically closer to Biden. Like, it's not straight down the middle in that it's not, you know, $1.5 trillion, although the Congressional Budget Office suggested that it might be close to $1.5 trillion, but if you read the fine print, it might be even less than a trillion. So there's still some debate over how much was actually cut. But yeah, so whether it's based on spin or based on numbers, can like one side really claim more of a win?
I will admit that I've only been viewing this from a, like, you know, 30,000 foot view. I was going to say like a normal American is watching it, but I'm sure that's not true because I'm sure the normal American is like, what? There's a debt ceiling. I think from my perspective, it seemed like they both got a win and that they both got a deal that was not terrible for them, which, like, you know, it's divided government. Like, you know, you're going to have to give something up, and both of them gave up a little bit, but not too much. So,
okay.
And sorry, I mean, the idea, we were talking about this in a chat last week where we were addressing this question of actually who lost more in the debt ceiling fight. And, you know, Biden is spinning this as something that's going to be good for his 2024 chances. But we're so far out from the election. You know, it's something that he can say now. Look, more examples of bipartisanship under Biden and getting things done and government working for you. But the reality is no one is going to be thinking about this when they actually go to the polls. So even if that is sort of an apparent win for Biden, I don't think that's actually going to pay a lot of dividends for him when it matters.
Is it empirically true that Joe Biden has overseen more bipartisan work under his presidency than recent past presidents?
I was trying to look this up, actually, mm-hmm. to see if there was some like study that has looked at this, and maybe there has been, and if anybody is aware of it, please send it to us. But I couldn't find anything, but it does kind of feel that way. But, you know, obviously this is a database podcast, not vibes, so I'm not gonna go there and say it definitively. But
right, because in a pretty high profile manner, you have the infrastructure, you have chips mm-hmm. and science, you have this, you have, you know, some gun control, violence against women, reauthorization. So like, there's clearly some stuff that it's not just spin to be like, I've overseen bipartisan work. There's something there. We'll have to do the empirical work to try to prove it one way or another. But are you guys ready to move on to 2024?
Yes. So ready.
All right, let's do it.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
If all goes to plan, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, former Vice President Mike Pence, and current North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum are all getting into the Republican primary race this week. According to polling averages, Trump still has more than 50% support in the polls, like 53, 54% at the time of recording. DeSantis has around 20%. and everyone else is in the mid to low single digits. Of the three candidates expected to get in this week, Pence polls best at around 5%, which is technically third place in the polls, although I don't know if that's even a relevant statistic, given that it's really sort of, if you look at our interactive, very crunched down there at the bottom of all of the people in the single digits. Christie and Burgum don't really register in the polls, maybe 1%. Or zero, but I'm gonna leave it to you two. Who should we talk about first?
Ooh.
And why?
I think we should probably talk about Pence first because he's the biggest name, and you know the others will.
It's boring.
So insulting to Chris Christie. So insulting.
Maybe he should be vice president, and then we can talk.
Ooh! Wow. All right.
Okay. Fine.
Come back to us, Christie.
We're gonna talk about Mike Pence first. That's not who I thought you were going to pick. I thought you were going to pick Chris Christie, but we're going to do Pence. So I think it's fair to say that prior to January 6th, he would have been considered one of the likeliest future Republican nominees in the country. Mm-hmm. You know, vice president, big credential. What did things look like on January 5th, and what do they look like now?
Well, Galen, if you could press that little tab right there, which is, if I think... Boom. Nailed it. I would like, for the record, all it did is that the tab said CIV, C-I-V, and I knew what it was, so I pulled it up. Okay, so this is a graph, which you won't be able to see, of Mike Pence's favorable and unfavorable rating among Republicans, and you can see that on January 6th, before January 6th, he was at basically...
To people listening at home, you won't know this, but what Nathaniel did was he pointed to a tab on my laptop that you couldn't actually see what it was because I had it open because I was doing prep, and he just guessed at what graph this might be.
Correctly, so, though. Yes.
Correctly.
Intuited.
So let's, on January 5th, among Republicans, Pence's favorability rating was like 90% according to the Civics poll. Civics does a good job because they have a running track record of polls of many politicians' favorability going back several years. So it's a useful reference in this tool. There's a big drop off to around 60-70% favorability after January 6th, and it's really only deteriorated since then. And in the current numbers, according to Civics, only 38% of Republicans have a favorable opinion of him and 42% have an unfavorable opinion of him. And like, those are numbers we're used to seeing like nationally among all like adults, right? Because like, you know, oh, we're a partisan country and everything's 50-50. But like, this is among Republicans. If you're trying to win the Republican presidential nomination and you are underwater with Republicans, that is a problem. And if you look at like Donald Trump's numbers and like Ron DeSantis's numbers, they have like 80% of like favorable ratings among Republicans. And like, that's basically like, it obviously like people almost certainly aren't going to vote for you if they dislike you. So it puts a ceiling on your support right away. And then, of course, there's all the stuff about Trump having a dominant lead and DeSantis being the kind of natural alternative and having to take them down while still remaining on like voters' good sides. It's a hard equation.
Well, and I mean, what Pence did to cause this rapid slide in approval among Republicans was he refused to go along with Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election, which Trump felt that Pence should be able to help facilitate. And since then, he has spoken out vocally against Trump. He's even testified in the special counsel investigation looking into Trump. And so he's turned into this kind of adversarial figure. But you know, he's running against his former boss, which is always going to be a bit of a tricky proposition. And he's got these negative approval ratings. So he's dealing with a challenge that any Republican who wants to come in criticizing Trump is going to have to deal with, which is that the Republican base is predisposed to believe Trump and trust Trump and not trust this person who Trump is saying, you know, he is the reason that I am not president right now. So it is a challenging situation for Mike. And, you know, he does represent this much more traditional brand of Republicanism. I mean, he's a very strong social conservative. He's, religious conservative, and he's trying to lean into that. But there's just not a lot of evidence. I mean, there's some evidence, for example, that Trump might be weak among white evangelicals, as we've talked about on the podcast. But it's not a huge amount of weakness. And it's also not clear that Mike Pence is the candidate who is actually in the best position to come in and scoop up those voters. So it's not a great outlook for him, unfortunately.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that, you know, being a former vice president is usually a very good place to be when you're running for president.
Like, unless you're Dan Quayle.
Well, so the interesting thing is that actually, if you, our colleague Jeffrey Skelly in the article that will come out when Pence announces,
took what? It's already written?
I know.
Take a look behind the scenes, viewers.
I thought listeners. Jeff was going to write it once Pence actually announced.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, in those, just, like, in those 5 minutes in between when Pence announces and the article goes up, that's when everything got written. Yeah. Well, as Jeff will write, he went back and looked at the polling situation for the vice presidents, former vice presidents who have run for president or sitting vice presidents who have run for president. And basically the comp for Mike Pence is Dan Quayle in 2000, which is not a good place that you want to be. Obviously, Dan Quayle did not end up being the Republican presidential
Dan
nominee
Quayle
in 2000.
Dropped out in September, I think.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think it'll be interesting to see whether Mike Pence even makes it to Iowa.
Yeah.
Okay, so given everything we've said, a couple questions come to the fore. One, so that civics poll that you mentioned shows Pence actually underwater. If you take an average of Pence's favorability, he is above water with Republican voters. You know, Jeff will crunch those numbers between now and Wednesday and will publish them once Pence actually announces. Weirdly, I just had a dream in which I saw them last night, which is why I know what the actual average is.
What were they?
Sorry, I don't remember it that
well. He's got to consult the notes from his dream.
You're like your dream recall. You're pulling up your dream journal. Galen's dream journal
is this, therapy?
On his page. If this is what you talk about in therapy, Galen, I'm so sorry.
his net favorability is plus 17. So that's all polls considered, which is significantly better than civics. So, I mean, that's notable, right? Because Trump's kind of trashed the guy. Obviously, he had universal
right
support exactly. Right. Before January 6th.
And universal name recognition, which is the
key. And universal name recognition. So, one, who are his supporters? Is it more complicated than the religious right? And two, if our data suggests, and his campaign probably likely knows, that he's not going to win the Republican nomination, what's he doing?
Well, I mean, what are any of the people who are jumping in this week doing is the question then.
But isn't like unknown better than disliked? You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like,
Yes, empirically that is true. If you are unknown, you have a higher, it's still a long shot, but you have a higher chance of winning the nomination historically than if you are disliked.
So I think the thing that we kind of forget about Mike Pence is that he was not, like, he wouldn't have been a strong contender if he hadn't basically been the one person who agreed to be Trump's vice president. Like, what? You don't think that's right? Because he had these very strong social conservative credentials, right. But that was his base. There's a lot of competition for those people within the Republican Party. And as Trump's candidacy illuminated very clearly, they don't necessarily need someone who personally reflects their values and lives their values in a candidate. And that is one of the, you know, the big things that Mike Pence had going for him, that not only did he, push forward religious values at every turn, he really lived them in his life. And we saw from evangelicals' embrace of Trump, who is a very flawed candidate from the perspective of Christian theology, that, you know, they were more than willing to go ahead and support him because he was their crusader on so many other issues. And so I don't think that, you know, Pence, like, what is, he's the former vice president, he has name recognition, but I'm not sure he was going to bring a whole lot to the table, even if the January 6th stuff hadn't happened, if Trump is running.
Oh, if Trump was, yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
But I think if Trump had won, and then in 2020, then Pence would be the presumptive nominee in 2024.
Really?
Yeah. I think he would be a kind of a, yeah, he would at least be the front runner. He would maybe get challenged.
Okay,
I
mean, so why is he running?
Yeah. Good question. I think ego is a significant part of it, as it is for all of them, like Amelia said. I'll be interested to see how hard he goes against Trump, because given that he's kind of already burned his bridges with the people who like really love Trump, it seems like he would be positioned to and people have been talking about how, they need to attack, like the other Republicans in the race need to attack Trump if they're ever going to bring him down. And it seems like he's somebody who could do that. But I'm not sure that he is, he's like too nice almost to do that. And also a lot of if you badmouth anything that Trump did before January 6th, you're also implicitly badmouthing yourself, right? He's in a tough position. I don't really fully understand why he's running, other than the fact that, he's a former vice president and he wants to be president and, thinks that now is his time, or that his time may never come again and he might as well try.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe he looks at the Ron DeSantis slump recently and, his awkward interactions on the campaign trail, thinks that he could do better, thinks DeSantis is going to crash and burn, and then maybe that 20% support goes to him. And
maybe he's trying to stay relevant and the hopes that, in future he'll be able to run again. I mean, maybe it'd be better to flame out in the primary. I don't know. I don't understand the psychology. Honestly, I think it's 90% ego.
Most people run a couple times before they end up winning the nomination. And he's never run for president before because he didn't even run in 2016.
So you're saying he gets one of his shots.
Yeah,
now.
One of his shots now, sort of get familiar, get that email list going, make impressions on the people who matter in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. I should remind any potential candidates for president listening to this podcast, though, that it is not true that there is only upside to running for president. I think that has become the conventional wisdom because so many people have done it and benefited from it, like Pete Buttigieg, a mayor from Indiana, or Andrew Yang, a tech entrepreneur. Like, people have been able to promote themselves quite a bit, get deals on television, or, get set up to run for other office, or what's happening right now with Vivek Ramaswamy, who's kind of came out of nowhere and now has this national profile. But, there are people like Beto O'Rourke, I don't think benefited from running for president. I don't think Michael Bloomberg benefited in any way from running for president. I don't think Julian Castro really benefited from running for president. I mean, he marked down some really progressive positions that are never going to help him win statewide office in Texas now. So there are ways that you can actually hurt yourself if the idea is that, like, why not run for president? You can always just go and get a deal on CNN or run for some different office. No, you might actually make yourself more disliked by running for president.
Right. And I think the key is that the most obvious disadvantage to running for president is that you burn your bridges with voters back home. And I think that's why you see former Vice President Mike Pence, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie jumping into the race. They don't have that to lose, right? It's not like Mike Pence is going to go back to Indiana and run for something, right? New Jersey, Chris Christie's career is over if he doesn't become president, right? The interesting thing is Doug Burgum, who is currently the sitting governor of North Dakota, who maybe would see his standing at home decrease, but, we can talk about him later.
Well, let's do it. Okay, so we've talked about Pence. Christie or Burgum, who's next?
Let's talk about Christie.
All right, let's talk about Chris Christie, and that actually tracks because Chris Christie's story is a bit similar to Mike Pence's in the sense that at least once upon a time, he seemed very promising as a potential Republican presidential nominee or candidate. And by once upon a time, I'm talking about 2012. He was the popular Republican governor of blue state of New Jersey. But he didn't run in 2012, and things haven't quite worked out for him with Republican voters since then. What happened?
Yeah. So basically, what happened was, I think he is the poster child for not striking when your political window of opportunity is in front of you, right? As you mentioned, in 2012, he was a popular governor. There were Republican donors knocking down his door to run for president because it was a very weak field. You had Mitt Romney, but he was polling in the 20s, which is not a kind of historically strong place to be for the front runner. This was the cycle when you had all these fad candidates. So there was Rick Perry had a moment, and then Herman Cain, and And there was somebody, Newt Gingrich, like, you know, all these people had little polling bumps. And it's very easy to see Chris Christie having
at least a
polling bump.
It would have been on
brand
if you couldn't remember the names, given Rick Perry's experience in 2012.
Exactly, right. Oh, poor Rick. So I think that that really was a very winnable cycle for many candidates who, you know, who maybe regret not, you know, not running or not, you know, doing, you know, a better job locking down support. Chris Christie passes that year. Things happen. So he, there was Hurricane Sandy, which he got good reviews for dealing with in New Jersey. But then there was the Bridgegate scandal, which was, this is when his aides like emailed like time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee. Basically, they closed lanes on the George Washington Bridge in order to politically retaliate against the mayor of Fort Lee, New Jersey.
Who didn't endorse him in his reelection.
Right. Exactly.
It was the most New Jersey story ever. It's like traffic, behind the scenes dealings,
corruption.
It's,
I think,
just
you're a little too close, geographically close to New Jersey right now to trash it so blatantly. You can save that for
whatever.
When you're back in DC.
No. DC's pretty close to New Jersey too.
You mean culturally? Yeah, it is a swamp.
Wow. Wait, are you on New Jersey's side or are you not on New Jersey's
side? I'm on the underdog side. I only defend New Jersey
New York City,
in situations like this.
I don't know.
Have I ever defended New Jersey this stridently.
Yeah, I know. This is like, I'm gonna hold you to this, Galen. You're very, very strong defense of New Jersey. I don't know, whatever. I lived in Chicago for a long time. I lived in New Jersey for a few years. I feel like I can talk about corruption lovingly.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah, like 10 years of my life.
We just started a show called
Collectively
How to Spot Corruption with Amelia Thompson DeVoe.
Oh, well, is it like, is the first thing move to Chicago and read the newspaper? Because that's all I've got for you folks. I'm sorry.
Okay, where were we? So
Bridgegate.
Yeah,
so Chris Christie's popularity tanked. He became pretty toxic. But then, of course, he decided to run for president in 2016 because, you know, he presumably wanted to run for president. And that was always his plan. And he was like, you know, why spoil a perfectly good plan? So he runs for president in 2016. You know, was never polling very good. I think he was at somewhere like 4% in our average at the time when he jumped in. He never, you know, really made any moves to improve upon that. And of course, he was kind of best known for basically taking down Marco Rubio in the New Hampshire debate and then dropping out after placing, I think, sixth in New Hampshire. And now, of course, theoretically, if reports are to be believed, he's running for president again. And he's in probably an even worse position. Like, his national favorable ratings were not good when, you know, in that 2016 campaign. And they are even a little bit worse now, according to Monmouth polling. He, you know, barely registers in the polls. He's like 0 or 1%, which is, you know, technically a little bit worse than 4%. But I think they're basically functionally the same. So basically, you know, and so the interesting thing, the question with him is, why is he running? And I think that's the interesting debate.
Right. So, Amelia, I'm curious. He has telegraphed that his intention is to, you know, bring the heat to former President Trump in this primary. That, you know, might have sounded a little bit more unique before Ron DeSantis got in and over the past week has done battle with him, although maybe in ways that are different from how Chris Christie will. How credible do you think his attacks will be?
I mean, that's the thing that he's struggling with, because I think there's an argument that Chris Christie is a uniquely pugilistic personality. We certainly saw this in 2016, that when he is on and he is zeroed in on someone, he really can make them look very bad. But the problem is that to make someone look bad and not to make, for example, Christie look ridiculous or like a bully, you have to have an audience that is receptive to that person looking bad. And the trick for Christie is that Trump is much more liked among the audience that he is trying to reach than Christie is. So it's a similar problem to Mike Pence, although I think Christie has much more of a brand as a fighter and, you know, a guy who's going to get into little tussles on the debate stage, not literally, although I don't know with these the debates, who knows.
Remember the Ohio Senate primary in 2022?
No.
Oh, they almost like.
They almost
brawled on stage during the debate.
That's right. Yeah.
Wait.
I don't think that was the debate. It was like some campaign.
Yeah.
It was like
a campaign forum. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like someone stood up and someone had to like, you know, talk like another candidate down. I don't even remember.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's just, it feels like it's like every year, whatever. Anyway. Yeah. So I think Christy is going to, that is something Christy is going to have to deal with. And I think it's going to be really hard for him to overcome because he's already, you know, positioned himself as kind of like the attack dog. Maybe he's in the best position to do that. But anyone who is attacking Trump is going to have to be careful to not inadvertently strengthen Trump. And I'm not sure that Christy is really the most, you know, trusted or sympathetic figure to Republican voters. I think, you know, someone like DeSantis, while there is a lot of risk for him in attacking Trump, is a figure with a lot more credibility among Republican voters if he wants to go after someone who is still very well regarded among the people who are going to be voting in early 2024.
Right, exactly. Like the problem is that like Chris Christie is not popular, similar to Mike Pence, or actually he was in an even worse position than Mike Pence because he, I believe, is underwater. And at least he was in the Monmouth poll. But part of that, I think, is, you know, because of this bad reputation that he kind of got leading up to 2016. But part of it is also, I think, that he's over the last couple of years been a Trump critic, also in the wake of January 6th. And I think that the harder he leans into that, the worse that favorability score is going to go. Right. It's not like basically like the source of truth in the Republican primary like is like Donald Trump, and like we recently had an article on the website by Michael Tesler, a political scientist, who made the case that basically like what is considered conservative is now defined around like basically are you pro-Trump or anti-Trump, and like the more like if somebody like Christie like attacks Trump, like that is like going to make like Republican voters view him almost like a Democrat, and then at that point it's like, well, you know, like basically,
how different is it from when Biden, any from other, Biden, exactly, any Democrat
or CNN
criticizes
or whatever criticizes Donald
Trump?
Exactly.
I will also say Donald Trump is not Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio, like no offense to him, was like, you know, he did not seem prepared for the heat that Christie brought. And this is what Trump loves. Like this is he breathes this kind of thing. So I think just objectively it's going to be harder for Christie to get his punches to land with Trump, even if this wasn't such an unfavorable landscape to begin with. So I think, you know, if we look back, we say yes, Christie has his track record of taking down front runners. I really would not put Marco Rubio and Donald Trump in the same category in terms of their ability to be publicly humiliated by Chris Christie. I think it's going to be much harder to do that for Trump.
Okay, so Chris Christie, Mike Pence going to be facing some similar challenges if they plan to run campaigns that focus on criticizing Trump. Doug Burgum, though, has a different plan, which is more of a cash-based plan.
We think.
I mean, he'd be an idiot not to.
So I, like our listeners, know relatively little about, I think this is the first time I've actually in a prep doc just put the Wikipedia article to the candidate and not like other information about like a write-up or some data or research or whatever. You're just like, here, read about when he was born, what he did for a job, where he went to college.
He was a chimney sweep. I learned that in...
From Wikipedia?
No, actually, from a Fox News article. But yeah, he was a chimney sweep. He worked at a grain elevator. He did something else that's like very, I don't know, sounds like it comes from a 1950s hard scrabble.
Like from Mary Poppins?
Or Mary Poppins. Yeah, sounds like he might be Dick Van Dyke. Like, I don't know if Mary Poppins is working in a lot of grain elevators, but to be fair.
I mean, you know, you've got to ingratiate yourself to Iowa somehow. And that's from true. What I hear, Mary Poppins is gunning for first woman president of the United States of America. Mm-hmm. So,
is she eligible?
I don't know.
She's not a natural born citizen. Is Mary Poppins? No,
she's not. Galen, I'm really sorry to burst your bubble.
I was thinking of pitching a whole like Disney Plus, you know, 538 crossover movie where Mary Poppins becomes president. Mm-hmm. But alas. Okay, so Doug Burgum, he's the governor of North Dakota and he's a billionaire. Those are the two main things that if you've heard of him, you know. Why is he running for president?
YOLO.
Again, ego. Like, you know, I think that, like, governors and senators, like, want to be president. Like, there's nowhere to go once you've become governor of your state and other than to D.C. And
but as we discussed, it's better to be unknown than yes. disliked. And so it sounds to me, in looking at some of the data and write-ups and whatever, that if you actually had to put your money on one of these three candidates that are getting in this week, you, even though you probably never heard of him, would probably put your money on Doug Burgum because
I would.
He can spend his money into recognition.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So he, unlike kind of the other kind of, wait, who candidates are, you know, I think he has like a path forward. Like, I don't think he's going to win the nomination. I think Donald Trump is the strong favorite for that. And just like historically, it would be nearly unprecedented for somebody kind of polling at, you know, 0 or 1% to win at this point. But Doug Burgum, he is a billionaire. He can self-fund if he wants to pour, depending on how much he wants to pour into his campaign. Like, that can go far. Like, if he wants to just saturate the airwaves in Iowa and New Hampshire, like, that'll probably put a dent in the polls. People probably remember what happened with Michael Bloomberg. He jumped in at the last minute in the 2020 Democratic presidential race, and obviously he didn't win, but, you know, he was a central figure in the primary, I would say, for a couple of months. And I think that is kind of, you know, what Doug Burgum can aspire to. Like, if you came to me from the future and told me that Doug Burgum finished third you know, in delegates
and won delegates from American Samoa,
yeah, basically I would say, yeah, that tracks.
Okay, so he should be aiming for what? Would like Michael Bloomberg on Super Tuesday only won delegates from American Samoa? Was that the case?
Well, Burgum is, I don't remember.
I think that Nathaniel was saying that he can do better.
And he's starting earlier. He could, you know, he's got the green elevator thing. So, you know, you could see him doing something
in Iowa
again, like finishing third or
whatever.
From
middle,
like,
America.
It's going to be hard to dislodge it's going to be nearly impossible, I think, to dislodge Trump. It'll be hard to dislodge DeSantis, although maybe you can make the case that, you know, if he doesn't hold up to the national scrutiny, there is an opening for that kind of alternative slot. But yeah.
Okay. Snark aside, he has a really compelling story that you started to get at. Amelia, can you tell us what else should we know about who Doug Burgum is?
Oh, he's a very successful entrepreneur. I mean, like American dream, this man. He created a software company. He sold it for a ton of money. And then, you know, Nathaniel will point out in the article that I have dreamt. I don't, why are we doing this?
You're still doing it.
Nathaniel pre-wrote this. Anyway, it's fine. This is how journalism works. If you don't realize that, I'm so sorry. And also, I can tell you something about Santa Claus. But anyway, yeah. And then in 2016, he jumps in to the gubernatorial primary and he looks like, you know, he's going to get blown out of the water by someone who is already a very established politician in North Dakota. And he goes on to win. So,
and he's self-funded in that case.
And he's self-funded. So it's not really that difficult to see why Burgum is looking at the situation that we have now, where there is this perception of weakness on, you know, on the part of DeSantis. There are all these other kind of low-polling candidates, none of whom seem particularly compelling. And he's thinking, I have all this money. You know, I do have a track record as governor of North Dakota, and he can kind of, you know, mold his own image, which is not something that pretty much, you know, I mean, other people like Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, like, can to a certain extent, but they're already fairly well known and they don't have bottomless reserves of cash. So, you know, he's in an interesting position. You've convinced me that he's one to watch, Nathaniel.
So something that I learned from also having a similar dream to yours, Amelia, was that his plan centers around basically talking about the economy. He's kind of a nerd on economic policy, and it depends on which way you squint. He could be either seen as a rock-ribbed conservative or more of a moderate type. It sounds like he wants to run in maybe more of a moderate lane, although I'm not really sure. I mean,
I think we're going to learn a lot about him when he announces. Yeah,
yeah. So, it's going to be really interesting.
Yeah.
But I thought the most interesting thing in your piece, Nathaniel, was actually pointing out how much of a difference the money can make. So he has over $1 billion. If he were to spend, for example, $20 million by the end of the year, or I think it was $50 million by the end of the year, that would put him in the ranks of very few people who have ever run for president, right?
Yeah, there's a table in my piece of everybody who's raised $50 million by the end of the odd year before the election. And it basically, it's, you know, it's full of a lot of people who didn't win the nomination, but like people whose names you've heard of. So it's like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and, you know, I think, you know, Ted Cruz in 2016. And
Hillary
stuff like
Clinton
that.
And OAN,
a couple of people who flopped, like Tom Steyer.
Tom Steyer's right at the top.
He's the cautionary tale, right? Who is, you know, he's the random rich guy who came in, spent a bunch of money, and they basically had nothing to show for it.
But not a politician.
But exactly. But Burgum, the crucial difference is that he has political experience, which I think is a big differentiator. And he's a rich guy, which those two things together can be powerful.
Well, we're going to have to meet back up and talk about how Burgum spends his money and what kind of message he puts out. But for now, let's talk about whether he'll even make the stage in the first place. Last Friday, the Republican National Committee released the criteria for the first Republican primary debate, which is going to be held on Wednesday, August 23rd. We'll see you there. The criteria include various qualifications. Participants need to have 40,000 unique donors with some geographic diversity of those donors. They need to sign a pledge committing to support the eventual nominee and to not participate in non-RNC sanctioned debates. They also need to poll at 1% or above in three national polls, or 1% in two national polls and 1% in an early state poll. But here is where things get interesting, at least from our perspective as the poll people. The poll must, and I'm quoting here, survey at least 800 registered likely Republican voters through a mix of live calls, integrated voice response, online panel, and or text message, not overly weight responses of any individual cohort beyond the margin of the error of the poll. If you're confused at what that means, me too. We'll talk about it. Ask the question on presidential preference prior to any question which may allow potential bias, and also not be conducted by a polling company affiliated with a candidate or candidate committee. So some pretty stringent rules there in terms of which polls even qualify towards getting that 1%. Now, is this a good or bad use of polling? And there's a lot of different criteria here, so maybe some are good and some are bad. You can tell me. But who wants to go on the record first? Amelia, are you ready?
I mean, I think in general it is a good use of polling to try to use polling to set some kind of standard for who can make it into the debates. I mean, I think we all, having lived through the 2020 Democratic primary, it's just incredibly chaotic when you have lots of people, especially people who really have no chance of winning, up on the stage distracting from the people who do have a chance of winning. That being said, these criteria taken together seem like they are potentially going to pose some problems for the Republicans.
Okay, to make this easier, I'll just go point by point and you say good or bad. So we're going to start with
Can we do thumbs up and thumbs down?
Yeah.
So we're...
Well, the listeners back home have to be able to...
Oh, I'm so sorry.
We don't just have viewers. So...
I forget what medium this is. I'm terribly sorry,
listeners.
We've been
dazzled by the lights.
Yeah, exactly. We came to the big city.
So the opaque one first. Not overly weight responses by any individual cohort beyond the margin of the error of the poll. Good use of polling or bad use of polling?
I mean, I
don't know what it means.
Right.
I don't know what it means.
I think bad use I don't know what it is. But if they can explain it and it makes sense, then I'm willing to change my mind. We have asked the RNC to clarify that. And as of before the podcast, they had not gotten back to us.
Okay. So we'll take that for now as at least a not entirely coherent use of polling.
incoherent use of polling. I like that as adding to our metric.
Next one. Ask the question on presidential preference prior to any question which may allow potential bias.
I like that.
Yeah,
that's good.
A good use of polling.
Good use of polling. Fabulous. Not be conducted by a polling company affiliated with a candidate or candidate committee.
That's good.
Use of polling.
Good use of polling.
Obviously, otherwise you just have their pollster get in and go in the field before the debate and be like, look, our candidate's doing so well.
Okay, so we have out of the three, incoherent, and then two good uses of polling. Lastly, survey at least 800 registered likely Republican voters through a mix of live calls, integrated voice response, online panel, and text message.
This is going to be a problem.
This one's medium. Yeah. So like, I appreciate what they're trying to do, which is like they want a poll with a large sample size, like, you know, those polls have lower margins of error and like that's good. But also like that's not super realistic in this day and age. Polling is expensive. There are not a lot of polls that do this. So I have
here
in my hand.
And there's the likely voters piece, too.
That's true, yes.
Which I get. They could do registered voters. Right, they could do registered voters. Yeah. They want people. It's like really hard to figure out who is a likely voter when we're so far out from voting.
Right.
Well, so that's the part that I actually, of all of it, like the sample stuff, I get. I think it is going to be a problem for them potentially down the line. The likely voters part, I'm less on board with.
Amelia, I'm with you because it adds a lot of subjectivity into the results of the poll. When you put a likely voter screen on your data, somebody could go from polling at zero to polling at two, or what, you know, like, and it's really up to, there's a lot of different ways that you can screen for a likely voter. You can just ask them, do you plan on voting in the primary? You can look at their history and determine for yourself whether you think they're going to vote in the primary. And also, at this point in the process, we're mostly looking at registered voters anyway, not likely voters. So,
and even registered voters is dicey because people can register. People like people who vote in the primaries might not be registered right now.
Right, right. We're still very, very early. It feels very early to be focusing on likely voters. And then because of the problems that I think Nathaniel is about to talk about, it also winnows the number of polls that they can be drawing from quite substantially.
Right. So I have here in my hand a list of 13 polls that have been conducted that meet these criteria. The entire cycle. 13 polls the entire cycle. Only 9 of them were conducted this year. So if you go, there have been 5 months so far in the year. So that's like basically like 2 polls per month. The window for the poll and criteria is July 1st to, I think, August 21st, like 2 days before the debate.
It's a so whole like, hot 6 weeks.
Based on the pace that we're at, we're looking at like what, like 4
maybe
polls?
Less, yeah.
Like, we're, right. And so I should also note that one of these polls was conducted by Donald Trump's campaign. So that would be thrown out. So actually, there have only been 8 polls that meet this criteria so far this year. So it's just not a lot, and it's really going to rely on pollsters like stepping up and like proactively being like, you know, yes, basically they're going to make this decision because they're going to be like, do we want to have 801 respondents or 799 respondents to be like chosen or like to be a criteria for this debate? And like, I think a lot of pollsters aren't going to want to spend all the money to go all the way up to 800 respondents.
And so it puts quite a lot of power in the hands of these pollsters.
Just a few pollsters.
Who are willing to go into the field. Right. And, you know, it could make the difference in terms of who makes it onto the debate stage, which I'm sure the candidates are very unhappy about.
Usually the sample is more like 500, right?
Yeah, or even less.
Or even less. Okay, so basically the RNC is telling pollsters spend significantly more money reaching, you know, 50% or even 60% more respondents or your poll won't count. And then pollsters have to.
But pollsters might not see that as a bad thing. Because I remember in 2020, a lot of pollsters were not happy about the fact that their polls were being used because of margin of error and things like that. Like, it can be arbitrary whether a candidate gets 0 or 1% in any given poll. So, yeah, they're going to have trouble, I think, finding the polls.
So, based on this, we wouldn't be surprised if the RNC revises some of this or.
Maybe.
I think we have to see what happens.
Yeah.
I mean, I think maybe there is a world where more pollsters do jump in and we just get more, you know, bigger sample size polls. And, you know, that's a good thing. That'll be a good thing if that happens. It's just going to be a problem if we're going into the August debate and we have 2 polls that are going to decide who's going to be on the stage. Then I think the RNC is probably going to be under a lot of pressure to rethink it.
All right. Well, if you work at the RNC and you have thoughts on all of this, reach out.
Please explain to us what the second bullet means.
What the waiting
means. We've asked you. We would like to know.
I mean, I sense that what they're trying to do is remove the subjectivity of the pollster, but they're adding the subjectivity back in through requiring it to be a likely voter poll, which doesn't totally make sense to me. Anyway, it's not meant for me. It's meant for democracy. So please explain its use there. We'd love to hear from you at podcast@538.com. But for now, thank you, Amelia and Nathaniel. This has been fun.
It's been thank really you, fun. Galen. Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Kevin Ryder is in the control room, and Ben Schalfefer is on video editing. You can get in touch by emailing us, as I mentioned, at podcast@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we will see you soon.